studied because we are exploring. In fact, I dare say it would increase. The issue of production, when you have 30-year facilities, is a radically different issue from exploration. There are many ways to improve production and monitoring and design opportunities once you know specific information of where and how much and what your goal is. It can be questioned and dealt with during the EIS process prior to any development. The EIS process has been designed for just that, to address the issues that we're talking about now with respect to actual oil, gas reserves and development of those reserves. There are two points about discovery you have to understand. If there is a discovery of significant quantities of oil and gas that would be economical to produce, it would be difficult to stop development of the reserve. But at the same time that it would be difficult to stop development, it is easy to ensure that you can have environmental controls and that will be environmentally benign. If exploration is successful, development will likely proceed, but it will be overseen every step of the way, including a long lead time before any initiation on construction of facilities. While the environmental implications of development are far less easy to determine at this time, or at the time you even find your resource, you have knowns that you can deal with. You know your resource, you know the specifics of the problems that you're going to try to solve, such as Caribou Passage. And you can attack those specifics through the EIS process and through an intensive permitting process. If exploration is unsuccessful, we all walk away like our wounds. While I have this opportunity to speak to you, I'd also like to add a few words on the Caribou Agreement being discussed with the Canadian government. While we recognize there's been a significant amount of improvement in the language of this treaty, we still have great concerns that it is not in the state's best interest, and it's not going to facilitate the process of getting ANWR opened in Congress. There are problems in the treaty that it contains mandates and not guidelines, and you can create potential legal and litigated problems. If the agreement is intended to be just a coordinating effort and nothing more, it should be stated very clearly, and it is not. And new standards that have legal parameters should not be created. However, I don't think we're against the treaty per se. It's a question of timing, because once the treaty is signed, there will be definite operational costs, there will be definite bureaucratic requirements, there will be a definite cost in terms of time, and there is really no added benefit that anybody can persuade me to the Caribou population. I believe that they're going to get intense focus from both Canadians and the Americans, regardless of the treaty. The treaty really facilitates diplomatic efforts more than it facilitates practical efforts with regards to Caribou.
Ann, could I stop you there a minute?
Sure.
You're referring to this memorandum of agreement on the Porcupine Caribou as a treaty.
Yes, sir. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's not a treaty.
You're correct.
It hasn't been signed off. It's been initialed, and it's in a memorandum of agreement. So for the record, because you were scaring me as you were going down,
I think originally, way back in the discussion, it initially started as that, and you are correct. It is a memorandum of agreement, and I stand corrected.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, too, it's been referred to in the newspapers as a treaty also.
Right. I am discussing the one that was initialed in Seattle. And
okay,
I'm
that's a memorandum of agreement.
And it is a memorandum of agreement. Mm-hmm. However, we assume that it does have the force and effect of law and regulation, and that it will be represented through reference in any ANWR opening legislation or any Title II action. And by the fact that we're, as a state and federal government, are responsible to maintaining their agreements within this.
It will probably be referred to in ANWR discussions back in Washington, but it has not been signed. It's only been initialed, and it's a memorandum of understanding, and I think they have to go forward with before it...
It would have to be signed first, and I guess what I'm saying is I really don't think it's in the best interest of getting ANWR open at this time to sign it now. I don't think it brings any benefit to sign now that it wouldn't bring later. In fact, it might be more supportive of the state's efforts to have ANWR open to responsible leasing. to have it signed later.
Go ahead. Continue.
That's really the gist of what I wanted to say, and I'm here to answer any questions you may have.
But, Pam, it was indicated in a press conference by the administration that they needed 10 more years of study in an area called a core calving area,
mm-hmm.
Which is at the foothills of the in the 1002 report, and we have exhausted that to the point where that we found that there is no such a thing, or that the terminology core calving area is probably a misnomer, that it's more a cross path, that if you overlay 10 years of migration habits, why this is an area where the caribou have crossed over more than they have in any of the other.
It represents an area that has had frequency of use, but not necessarily frequency of use by the majority of the herd. In the years where it has been designated as an area that has been used, all you know is that there have been at least 50 caribou, including calves, per square mile. It means nothing in terms of having the majority of the caribou present to have mapped it under that term of frequency of use. So, in fact, for the years where Dave Rosner examined his own data, he found the average percent of the herd using the core calving area, quote-unquote, when it was given credit for being there that year, averaged between 25 and 30%. At most, there was one year, I believe, that was 50%.
Well,
but that's not high.
And in the state's position that they, and the only thing we have, the only thing this committee has got to go on, there's a couple of press releases that were made by the governor, and one of them he stated that they were going to ask that this area be set aside for 10 years so that they could study it. And I guess that's one of the reasons why we exhausted the better part of one full two-day hearing to it. But I noticed that in the testimony today by Mike Bradshaw indicates that it's more likely that it's going to take 10 years from discovery for the first production, and it's going to take at least 5 years before you can get to discovery with all of the permitting that they have to go through. So we're talking about 10 years, and more likely, he says, but more likely to extend as long as 15 years in the case of the Anwar Coastal Plain. So we're talking about almost 20 years before we have oil flowing from well discovery into pump one.
Okay.
And in that time, why is your position that we then would have an ongoing overview of how these caribou are acting, and that we would not have to
definitely there's
close
no
off
need
it.
Not to study while you're doing exploration. In fact, as much as you can design exploration to be environmentally benign, you can also use it. It facilitates studies of certain questions in terms of just local disturbance. I'm sorry that during the Kickwell that we did not take that opportunity, or we're not given that opportunity to study any interaction between a single well and caribou. As you know, it was stipulated on that well that operations had to cease. There was a seasonal limitation from November through May. Not only that, the rig had to be laid down. So opportunity was lost. I think definitely caribou research will proceed whether or not exploration is allowed to happen in the summer.
I imagine you're pretty much familiar with our little flyer, General Comments from Standard Oil, and I want to compliment the company on this, and maybe I could ask you one further question.
Sure.
On the migratory habits of the caribou and their calving and the areas that they calve in, we notice that there's in this publication that there are large areas where that they have large...
Definitely.
And that they go way over here, almost over to the Mackenzie River, and all the way down. And I guess my question to you is the company, does your company have an exchange with like companies that drill on the Arctic Plain, particularly in the Mackenzie Delta area, during that migration? And was there any disturbance to their habits or to the aesthetics of doing
to my the... knowledge, there are not studies available from the Canadian side on that. I know we have personally attempted to gain any information that's been written up on caribou, and we don't have any information from them. Although I was not the one to personally contact any of the companies operating there, I know our company has pursued that. So I have to assume that there was nothing significant done. In terms of coordination, the monitoring over the last 14 years has been coordinated with the Canadian government by the federal government in this country. So that
the two federal governments?
Yes, so that all the data that you see in our handout, and as well as in our detailed comments on the 1002, was data put together by Fish and Wildlife through cooperation with the Canadian government and through cooperation with, say, Alaska biologists.
That isn't what they told us. We'll have to go back to Fish and Wildlife on that next time around, because they gave us the indication that they. Correct me if I'm wrong, but they gave us the information that the Canadians just went in, didn't have an impact. They went in and they drilled. They did not carry any environmental concerns to the herd whilst they were drilling on the Canadian side. But now that we want to drill on the American side, why, this is their big issue.
I wasn't addressing the Canadian industry when I said they did studies on their side. I was addressing the Canadian government. Mm-hmm. And I can't answer whether the industry put out any effort in terms of caribou protection or study, because I have not received any information from them.
Senator Jones?
Just a little more clarification. When we asked the Fish and Wildlife, Federal Fish and Wildlife Service, if they had information from the Canadian government side, they said no.
Well, I understand during the early years when the studies were being conducted by Dave Rosenow, at least during those years, and that information has been used by Fish and Wildlife, he did coordinate with the Canadians.
Okay.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Through the Chair, and I catch that in your testimony, I believe it's the first time we've had presented to the committee something that I think is going to be incredibly important before Congress, and that's where you talk about the difference between exploration and development, mm-hmm. Where there's a very strong feeling, certainly on the state level and apparently on the federal level, that if you begin the process and you allow the exploration, development will follow. And this was a big controversy in the Bristol Bay area of allowing it to happen. And then all of a sudden we envisioned pipelines and tankers and so on, without that tremendous step that comes after exploration, and that's what do you have, how do you get it to market, what are the conditions under which you develop, almost as though that if you explore and find it, the development is going to take place, but that may or may not be true. And I think that's one of the things we may be faced with, and I wonder if you'd care to comment, if ANWR were to be opened simply for exploration, and a review by Congress. Has there been any discussion at the corporate level? I see lots of problems.
I have not been involved in those discussions, uh-huh. But as a personal observation, I'd like to say, seems to me the investment required for the exploration wouldn't be made unless people thought they had an opportunity to produce
develop.
Something they might find. It's not logical.
Mm-hmm.
Just as I might add, I don't know that people would invest great amounts in a well prior to leasing if they thought they had to share all the information.
I think, though, the case has to be made that there is, that it's a real important point that you bring, that you have the controls through the whole process as to how that happens. And as we know, that can be exceedingly cumbersome, long time to happen, with very major design opportunities and all kinds of things to build that protection in. And I would assume that it's even possible to make it so costly in terms of design. Say you got into a major caribou area and weren't able to convince the licensing or the ones granting permits that you could do it safely, that you simply would not be able to develop.
For instance, if production weren't allowed on an annual basis, I find it hard to believe it would even proceed. Mm.
Senator Jones?
Mr. Chairman, I think the point that Senator Zulski and you were talking about, it, the process is evolutionary.
Definitely.
And as we go, we start with the exploration, And as we go, the caribou herds are moving all over the plain, not in just a core calving area, so that we're able to study the herd, and we stay with the herd wherever it goes, because if we study the core calving area, there's a lot of years they're not even there.
Correct.
So we're able to start the exploration, we see how they interact with the exploration process, and then it moves on into the development of, eventually, development of the oil, bringing the oil out. And it's evolutionary. And we do things, and we may do a wrong thing, but we draw back and we say, okay, we'll do this good another way. And isn't that the way, in fact, the way Prudhoe Bay has gone and the park, and as we've gotten better as we go?
I can guarantee that the controls on our activities are so stringent that if we discover something has been done incorrectly and something has had an impact, everything will cease to go forward until that is mitigated and that problem is solved. When you have a problem and you have oil to produce, you can find a way to solve it. It may take time, and it will certainly take a lot of heads together on the same issue and a lot of approvals before anything goes forward. But I think it's fair to say that our history is that we've been able to prevent problems from happening just by anticipating in every stage and evaluating what we've done in every stage. So I don't anticipate that we will create a problem. But if that were to happen, I can guarantee it would be fixed. It would not be allowed to happen a second time or even to continue. We have many permits and they can be revoked at any time.
That's the whole process of the permanent of the permit system, is that a lot of people don't realize that, Ann, that a issuing of a permit is an ongoing thing. That can be revoked at any time. A lot of people think, well, I'll go do my permitting and get the permits and then go forward, but they're monitoring you all the time.
It's a very slow process even to go forward just looking at a recent example like Endicott helps understand that one.
Any other questions of Ms. Brown? I seen you shaking your head, Ann, back there when we were in discussion before. Is there any other comments that you might want to make outside of your prepared text? You almost left the chair a couple times.
Outside of my prepared text and outside of my representation of Standard Oil and just as an interested citizen, I'd like to say that I think there is no perfect way to open everything in purely the state's interest. That if we look at it from a national perspective, we have to have some flexibility as well as asking them to have some flexibility. And so there's a risk involved in knowing whether you're doing the perfect thing in terms of state's interests or not. And I think regardless of whether they're land trades or how the revenue sharing issue is resolved, I think there are major advantages to the state to have ANWR opened. And that there's got to be some sort of flexibility on our part if we're going to be able to push it through Congress. That's all.
Good question.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ann Rupp. Very good. That finishes our list. We have at least an hour and or at least 40 minutes. And is there anyone that is here in the audience that would like to make a comment to this committee? If you come forward and state your name, so for the record, and your affiliation. Yes, sir.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Bob Nelson. My address is 2625 4th Avenue. I come to Alaska on 36. I realize we have a wilderness area we're trying to explore for oil and this and that, but my range of thinking is going to be probably quite different. And that is, when I was a child, my dad took my brothers and I for a buggy ride. I don't think they probably drilled more than a half a dozen oil wells in that time. Today, we're looking at a depletion of oil. They might be drilling their last one in my lifetime. Let's hope not. I would prefer that Alaska would start capping its wells that are available for capping rather than drilling new ones. We will never have enough money for the state of Alaska when all we have to do is elect the right senators and representatives and hold out our hat. This nation, along with Alaska, is growing nothing but parasites, and it's a terrible thing. Thank you.
Just wait a minute, Bob, before you leave the table, maybe there's some of the committee, if you would, maybe some of the committee would like to ask you some questions. Senator Fakes.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Nelson, let me assure you that Saudi Arabia has a 300-year supply of oil.
You can find statistics no matter where you look, and I'll say this, in the last 10 years, you'll read just as many statements by geologists that say we could be nearing the end. Who is to tell? Who's to know? The Creator, probably. And I'm sure when he laid down the vegetation for our oil, he did it with the intent that peoples on Earth would benefit, not just this generation, but our grandchildren and their grandchildren.
Any other questions? Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much. Frank Griffin. Frank, welcome to our table, sir.
Oh, thank you. And ladies.
Ladies?
Yes. My name is Frank Griffin. I live on my boat, box 6081 is my address, and my telephone number is 225-373.
Okay. Ah, dear.
I like to point out my background. I testified for the establishment of this before the senators in Fairbanks years ago of this Arctic Wildlife Range, and I don't remember whether I said I would like to see it ultimately open. I have to admit I forgot that. However, I am for it being open, because before that and also during after this been established, I've worked, lived, I've guided in the area, either Schrader Lakes and the Hula Hula,
mm-hmm.
and it's a little more unique than the Prudhoe area, but Prudhoe's fairly flat. And also, some of my employment on Dew Line, also with R&M Consultants, I every month went up and down the pipeline before the pipeline was developed, and for 3 years, flew up once a month, two times a month up down there, and I saw the development, the ruin of development in the area that we're working on and the adjacent areas. And I had a camp over in Galbraith Lake, and it didn't influence that very much as far as hunting. I do encourage the state to open the area. It's unique, but I think we need the oil. There are some isolated areas I think that should be protected in the thing, like the Peter Schrader Lake. If we can develop parts of the Anwar and go into the lake areas or some of the areas that may be accessible to the public and develop them as inviolate areas. And also on the coast at demarcation Griffin Point, no relation, there are some house rings, some archaeological digs of some importance, both to Canadians and ourselves, because it relates to some of the Canadian immigration peoples. I think that could be protected. I'm sure that once they get in there, a lot of people get in, they're going to try to develop offshore if they can. But I think some areas should be kept inviolate. And there are some areas that still do this, and I don't think it's going to disturb too much of the oil. Well, we'll bring up a comment.
Frank, those areas, those are uplands, aren't they? Those are up
Peter
in that.
Schrader's are. Actually, yeah. The ones at demarcation in Griffin are not. And, of course, the lower Hula Hula doesn't mean that much, but the upper Hula Hula is uplands, yes.
Yes, I mean, but what you're asking to be pristine is up in the.
Well, the areas I know that I mentioned, Peter Schrader, I mean, we've got a unique little area. There's been a study area, the area there in Caribou and Sheep with the Fish and Wildlife in the state, I believe, for years. But that can be protected, yes. That
okay.
One little area.
Yeah.
And make it, i.e. pristine if you can, because to develop more access, actually, the oil line will develop access to the Arctic. There's no getting around it. We have a in the highway, the
Dalton.
Prudhoe?
The Dalton.
The Dalton now, and people are using that.
No.
And I don't
no.
know.
No, Frank, they're not.
No?
Not just. Yet. Just the commerce. Just
to Dietrich.
Just to Dietrich. But
that's close
they
enough.
Have they have ways of getting there, yes.
Yes, they are.
Sure.
I have seen them there, so
legally
I know there's somebody using it some way.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm not concerned much about the development with the having seen what the pipeline people did and working rather close to them. They were pretty conscientious. I would admire the prudent development as far as staying out of areas and maintaining the environment the way we'd like to have it maintained. And it didn't seem to do too much on the Caribou, which was one of the big problem to the environmentalists. But my real concern is, has the state learned a lesson? We went through several doggone periods. I know this is not related to the development per se. We went through several areas of military construction, dual line construction, and I lived in Fairbanks 30-some years. I lived here since 45. Every time this goes up, and as since we've become a state, we've kind of thrown, we think dollar bills is the answer. And I don't know whether we've learned a lesson or not. We're not even pressing on the pipe of the gas line as much as I think we should. And this is probably going to develop a gas resource. Are we going to let it sit for in perpetuity? I don't know.
No.
But I do suggest the state go ahead, try and get the area, set some areas aside, get some bodies to look at the areas that should be set aside. I recommend Peter Schrader in that little area on the corner of the state up there, the northeast corner. There may be others. And when they do, sit back and look and don't throw dollar bills at things, please. Are there any questions?
I was talking to the, this is just a point of information, Frank. I was talking to the people in the Yukon Pacific that are working on getting the gas line going, and they figure that their construction period to put the gas pipeline in to its completion so that they would be full capacity would be 12 years, that they're not going to try and do it in 1 year. Kind of along your philosophy that we don't have our ups and our downs of creating high influxes and then going down into valleys. But I you must have been a member of the Tanana Valley Sportsmen's Association.
Oh, I was. I testified myself in them.
Okay, well, I have a little article here that you might be interested in, and it's a statement. It's part of the congressional record, and it was when in 1959, when Mr. Lake, the chairman of the Tanana Valley Sportsmen's Association, was testifying before a congressional group wishing to open up and to create and testifying in favor of Senate Resolution 1899 to create the Arctic Wildlife Range. And this article goes down to the, and it was Mr. Bartlett who then was, or was Senator Bartlett then, because this was in 59, right after the Tanana Valley Sports Association on May the 14th, 1957, made the first public proposal to establish an Arctic wildlife range. We have consistently worked for the creation of the range since that date and wish to reaffirm our position. He goes into great detail about the Isaac Walton lead, the Wildlife Management Institution, the National Wildlife Federation, Wilderness Society, and all of them were in favor of the wilderness of the wildlife range. And down in the testimony, I said, how long have you been in Alaska, Mr. Bartlett said. Mr. Lake said, 15 years. Senator Bartlett said, what is your occupation? Mr. Lake said, I'm a consulting engineer, Mr. Bartlett. Have you been in the range area? Mr. Lake, I have not been in the range, sir. I have hunted at the west of the range in the Brooks Mountains, but I have not been in the proposed Arctic Wildlife Range. What, Senator Bartlett, was the proposal first made to the TVSA for a wilderness area or a wildlife range? And then Mr. Lake says, if I may, I would like to back up a bit on that, Senator Bartlett, and try to trace the history of this proposal and the way TVS became interested in it. We first heard of the proposal to create that which was called the Northeast Wilderness Area, I believe in 1953 or 1954. At that time, there was considerable opposition amongst the club members to this, as it was established such as it would establish such a wilderness area. At a later time, further information began to filter down to us about the Arctic Wildlife Range, and Senator Bartlett interrupted, what do you mean, filtered down to you? And Mr. Lake, reading the various magazines and literature that have been published in the conservation field, Senator Bartlett, well, the reason I was interested in, I had thought it was moving up from the TV, from the Tanana Valley Sportsmen's Association. Mr. Lake, I will come to that in a moment. Senator Bartlett, all right. Mr. Lake, sometime in the early part of 1957, the trustees of the Tanana Valley Sportsmen's Association felt that there was sufficient interest to warrant a further investigation of the Arctic wildlife range, and we accordingly invited Dr. Muir to come from the States and present his thoughts on the range to the club. He did so on the night of May the 14th, 1957, and the club found his position favorable and endorsed the idea, and as I have stated in my testimony, we have supported it ever since. Senator Bartlett, was Dr. Muir's presentation on a wildlife range? Mr. Lake, yes, sir. Senator Bartlett, not for a wilderness area? Mr. Lake, no, sir. Senator Bartlett, did Dr. Muir recommend at the time that mining be permitted? Mr. Lake, yes, sir. Does the bill now before us fairly represent the recommendations made by Dr. Muir? Yes, sir. That it's kind of interesting to go back in 1957, commenting on the same thing, and I just thought maybe that might be of interest to you, kind of bring you back into.
Well, you refresh your memory on a couple of points. One was that, if I recall, the room was very large, very much filled with environmentalists were in heavy attendance, and I had been very fortunate to spend about five summers hunting in the area, and when I'd worked on the new line, I used to take my periods of work off and spend the time in the hills. So I had been there and also flown into Peter Schrader's Lake with the Fish and Wildlife Service once, and I had a little idea what was going on in the country. But the majority of the people testifying were not people who had ever been there, including us. I think I was the secretary of the club at the time when Jim was president. But bringing us to the present, I don't know whether I was had a preservation's attitude. I did want that established. And I do want now what parts of it established in perpetuity to be undisturbed if possible. But this should be accessible. You can't make an area like the parks or like the range completely inviolate or give it to industry and say you can't come up here because industry has so many defensible projects. I think we should open the range, develop for the state. State learn a lesson from what they did with this big money we got from the oil this time and not screw it up again, please.
Senator Sturgeliski.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that any group that's forming to go back to Congress ought to contact you. I think you bring the kind of sensitivity of somebody that knows that area, understands it, and yet have a pretty pragmatic way that it can be developed with appropriate controls. Just for example, the dew line. That was people came in, now they're coming back, and they're going to rehab and bring those up. We're going to live in the Arctic. But you're talking about some very specialized knowledge, and I think could be very impressive before.
Working on the dew line is interesting. Excuse me, I didn't interrupt you. Working on the dew line is kind of interesting because if you fly over the dew line now, you don't see a tremendous spread of military stuff people in pretty well. It's just people who get out and wake from there occasionally, but it's not tore up. The two people that tore up the Arctic were the trees, except four people, the villages. They've done a good job wherever they could get their influence. There has been some private developments on the Firth River. The Firth River is a family had mining there. And if you're about 4 miles down from their mine, Robertson, that doesn't sound right. But anyway, get 4 miles down from their camp, you don't even know they've been mining on the river. And that's in Alaska on the Firth. So private industry has not been so bad, but the Navy, the PETFOR development, which had no constraints on doing anything. To protect the environment. Matter of fact, there's a picture of a great big G for Gubik that they took a 8D cat and made a big G on the tundra out there. You can see it when you're flying over, you know where to look for it. So I think the pipeline people did very well. And I was there, as I say, sometimes I was there for weeks at a time. And I flew over it repetitively. And I did not see anything that I would say as an Alaskan was rash, brash, and destructive. Are there any other questions?
I'd just like to say that individual testimony was we had to come all the way to Ketchikan, the furthest away from the Arctic, to find some of the best. So
thank you, Frank. I made an effort to get here because I didn't think there were too many people down here that really had been up there. There may be, I don't know, but environmentalists tend to impact your kind of committees, and they don't give a realistic view. I don't think. I'm not anti-environmentalist, but
Representative Sun.
Oh, I had a question, Frank. You commented, has the state learned a lesson?
Has it?
Well, I guess I want to ask you is what lesson? Because there's a lot of different people that look at it a lot of different ways.
Well,
my point of view, so maybe you could just lay out what do you think we've done wrong?
What you've done wrong? Very simply, you use dollar bills and programs and expanded ourselves to the point that when any deflation comes in the income, we hurt.
Okay, if I could follow that up, then I guess, and I thought that's what you meant, is what should the state do with its money? Right now, we put it into operating budgets, we put it into capital programs, we put billions of dollars into loan programs, particularly housing. We put money in a permanent fund, which is kind of a savings account, and we've given money directly to the people. And I guess, and I understand what you're coming from, the state gets this huge amount of money, and if you look at the graphs from 81, 82, 83, it just jets up and now it's coming down. If we got that pile of money again, and it's only an if, what should we do with it?
There are a whole bunch of them I haven't developed in my mind. There's not a whole bunch. There are several areas I think that could be addressed. One, there's nothing wrong with having a big savings account. I don't think there's the biggest savings account in the world.
I agree with you.
Giving money to the people, and that includes myself, I don't think is the answer. Increasing our seniors and making, if I may kind of digress at the moment here, I looked at some of the other state entitlements for seniors, and it does not seem that constitutionality in Alaska is constitutional with other states. I don't know where that constitutionality lies, only in the state of Alaska, and one man can make that decision. But we do have a senior problem, and we're going to have a senior problem 20 years from now, and more so. We also have a juvenile problem. And these are kind of the human areas, humanities, I should say, perhaps could be addressed with a lot more money. And I don't mean throw it out and make a big billing programs, but be a little more sage about putting your money in the bank. My children and my grandchildren are here, are going to be hurt from what you people have done, not you specifically, perhaps yes, perhaps no, but they're going to hurt from some of the programs that you've addressed and can't continue. We can't just go putting money as a salve or introduce a program which costs multi-millions of dollars and say it's going to keep on going. We've got to be a little more like fathers in the family if we're going to be legislators. We've got to look up for the kids and our grandchildren. And we're not doing that. We're spending like drunken sailors to some degree. And I would say specific programs be in the humanities. Education be enhanced a little more. And don't cutting back on education, keeping it going and developing it more in the cities. We big in the communities. We've got a problem of not really aggressively bringing the native populations into a economic stream with Alaska. Now, I know they're addressed lots of ways, but they have their goals where they want to go, and I don't think the state has opened all the good programs for them. And I'm not saying programs, just dollar bill type programs. I mean, maybe we should develop the communities a little more and ride on those communities until they learn the new area, new way of doing things. Don't tear it up because you just got it for free. These are things that I can see we do.
Appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, to digress a little from the end.
We're getting
you for your comment.
Quite off there. Thank you. Thank you very much, Frank. Is there anyone else that would like to make a statement? Is there anyone else that would like to make to come forward and reiterate a statement or yeah. If we do not, we're not going to be coming back this afternoon because the committee is a resource committee. We're going to go out and take a look at the mill. We're going to take a tour of the mill and go over and see the sawmill and get a little idea of what these people from the rainforest tell us up in Juneau. So with that, there's
Mr. Chairman, before we close, could I bring up a short issue?
Yes. Senator Sturgeluski.
Fine. With Representative Sun here, it seems to me, just in the, this is the third community now with the hearings, we've pretty exhaustively gotten information from the feds and the state and in public on land issues, caribou forever, and seismic. And the two areas probably, the question, John, that you have hit in the House hearings that we haven't had that much testimony on would be, one, the economics of the line, and two, the local hire issue. Is that generally, would you agree?
We spent an entire hearing on local hire, mm-hmm. and then we spent a hearing on, I guess in a general sense, benefit to the state, mm-hmm. which we got into the economics, which you touched on here quite a bit, the 90-10 split. Okay. But what is the revenue situation of the state under the 1920 Mineral Leasing Act, under the land trades as they're being proposed now, under possibly an overriding royalty, the different land ownership patterns? And then we did touch just a little bit on the impact of what size of tariff on the line.
I think that's the only area probably we have not really had testimony on.
You know, if we get into a net back value at pump A in Anwar, the tariff on the line issues all the way have gone from $2 to $5 or $6. Well, if you tack that onto the TAPS tariff of $4.60 now, you could be up in the $8, $9 range net back just to get it to Valdez. Mm-hmm. And then our tanker charges, if we can't run this stuff in the world market, but it's got to go to the U.S. market, you add another, $5 to the Gulf on that. So you've got to have, even at $15 oil, your net back to Anwar could be zero. And so what we're trying to develop is what are the criteria that would determine the tariffs, size of the line, the length, the construction cost, the volume of oil that's going to be pumped through it, which is really a big factor. I mean, if you pump 100 million barrels versus you pump a billion barrels, makes a big difference. So we touched on those, but not to the degree, any significant degree. They just kind of came up in an hour and a half meeting.
Mm-hmm. What about local hire? Is that of some benefit to explore in detail? I mean, it's a pretty simple thing. Either you do or you don't, and you're
constitutional.
You've got constitutional problems, and it so much as intent.
The issue came up with the land trades. The native corporations have stated that they have a much, much tighter degree to demand local hire under there, and I think the Nana Corporation agreement with Cominco has come up as an example of they have three tiers there. I think Nana, Northwest Alaska, all Alaska before you can go outside. There is some discussion that under the federal land leasing laws or gas leasing laws, they could mandate local hire within their leasing structure.
If it's on their private land.
On the federal land. And then what could the state do? So those are kind of tiers of what could happen. Of course, what is local hire is always a question. And then the political ramifications that I think AFL-CIO Teamsters have taken, that if there is no local hire consideration, they will oppose opening the Anwar on the congressional. Level. And that was testimony in front of our committee, and I think that's a consideration that has to be taken into account in terms of if you're into develop consensus points to go somewhere. And they tacked in local hire and a minimum wage. They had two concerns. Well, I don't know if it was Davis Bacon, but it was some agreed upon wage agreements. So
project labor agreements.
Project labor agreements, I guess, was the language they used. So.
Are you done?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Just for the record,
the chair, our agenda, the agenda that I set for the subcommittee, didn't skirt those issues. We brought those in with it. The House is doing their Anwar overview in a whole different mode than what the Senate's doing, and we're striking at the issue in a different way, although those economic factors do come in. The thing is that when we look at Anwar being open for production in 10 to 15 to 20 years, what we're looking at is we're looking at $33 oil, too. And we've had that presentation made to us, and I chose not to go into hypothetics down the line on costs, because what the costs are in 1996 or year 2000 are conjectured at their best, and so we put our energy more towards how do we focus to get a consensus of opinion, i.e. open or not open.
Right. And I think, Mr. Chairman, you have also taken your committee on the road, so to speak, and out into the area, and I appreciate you coming to Ketchikan, where the House committee is going to hold all of its hearings in Juneau. So I think between the two committees, the people of the state are getting an exposure, and our approach is a little different than yours, but I think combined we should come up with a good product.
Good.
Yeah. I thank you very much for coming to Ketchikan.
Is there any other business to come before the subcommittee? Any comment? If not, why the Ketchikan subcommittee adjourned?
And the weather...